Coming up on Tech News Today, why Mozilla wants fragmentation, Google fears Samsung, and Opera is embracing the monoculture. All that and more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Tuesday, February 26th, 2013. Tech News Today is brought to you by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell last year's gadgets. Find out what your used iPad, MacBook, iPhone, Galaxy S, and other smartphones are worth at gazelle.com. And by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why we love our cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs, and RingCentral is $20 a month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial. Buy one desk phone, get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit RingCentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Aya Zakhtar.
And I'm Jason Howell.
And this is the show we keep you up to date on the most important stories in the tech world, starting each time with the top 10 stories of the day, the news fuse. That's dramatic because Internet Explorer 10 finally rolled out to Windows 7 users today. The newest version of Microsoft's browser previously was only available on Windows 8 or Windows RT, i.e. 10 is considered faster, more stable, and more standards compliant than previous versions of IE. Still, not everybody gets the new browser. Users of Windows Vista are stuck with IE 9 or earlier, and Windows XP stragglers can only use up to IE 8. But whatever you're doing, get off IE 6, for goodness sake.
Mozilla Chief Executive Gary Kovacs thinks the world needs Firefox OS. Apple and Google simply cannot do it on their own. At least that's what he inferred in a speech at Mobile World Congress today. He says, quote, "I find it impossible to understand how 3, 4, 5, or 6 billion people are going to get their diverse needs satisfied by 1, 2, or 5 companies, no matter how delicious those companies are," said Kovacs. "Is the farmer in the Indian countryside going to have the same needs and requirements as a lawyer sitting in New York?"
Did your kid spend money on an in-app purchase? Then you may be entitled to cash or even a settlement. Apple was the subject of a lawsuit over bait apps. Those are apps that are free to download but ring up dollars by selling virtual goods. That lawsuit is over, and here are the terms of the deal. Apple will offer a $5 iTunes credit to those who claim a minor bought in-game items without their knowledge or permission. If your kid bought more than $30 worth of stuff, then you might get a cash refund.
Call 1-800-IS for more details.
Don't.
The Pirate Bay has moved out of its native Sweden to bandwidth providers in Norway and Catalonia in Spain. Sweden's Pirate Party had been providing bandwidth to the file-sharing site, but received a warning from the Rights Alliance in Sweden that legal action would be taken after February 26th. Norway ISP Telenor fought off an IFP challenge to block the Pirate Bay previously, and Spain's Copyright Commission has taken no aggressive action in response to copyright complaints, hence the choice of those two locations. The Swedish Pirate Party is considering a police complaint against the Rights Alliance.
Dude, you're getting a new Latitude 10 Windows 8 tablet.
Woo!
Back at CES, Dell had introduced a budget-friendly Essentials version that was designed to appeal to the education market. Now at Mobile World Congress, it's unveiling the enhanced security configuration version. In this new model, you've got all sorts of security extras, like a fingerprint reader, integrated smart card reader, the Dell Data Protection Access Suite, the Tablet Trusted Platform Module 1.2 hardware, Microsoft BitLocker drive encryption, and CompuTrace tracking for lost or stolen devices.
ICANN says hundreds of new generic top-level domains will roll out this year. The first GTLDs will likely be non-English ones, according to the CEO of ICANN. Uncontested GTLDs will be the next to roll out. The ones that might take longer to get approved will be the ones like .music and .app, because there are a number of groups trying to claim them.
Location check-in service Foursquare announced a new partnership with Visa and MasterCard to offer discounts to credit card holders when they check in at participating retailers. Foursquare has a similar deal already with American Express. That one's been in place for 2 years. Foursquare will earn a fee now on every deal redeemed from all three credit card partners. First deal, get a buck off a burger at Burger King in the U.S. when you check in and spend more than $10. And you can use any of the three credit cards.
BlackBerry is beginning a pilot project with PT Bank Permata, that's the Indonesian bank partly owned by Standard Chartered PLC, to allow users to transfer money to each other over BlackBerry Messenger. BlackBerry chose Indonesia, which is a very large country, 249 million people, because it's still the leading smartphone brand there, and it's a foray into an industry dominated by mainstays like Western Union and MoneyGram.
Google announced Google Plus Sign-In can now be used to sign into apps and websites when developers implement it, similar to using Facebook and Twitter to sign in. Google Plus Sign-In will be available for Android, iOS, and web apps and come with, quote, protections and safeguards, as well as a feature that lets you decide what information you're sharing so you don't just spam everybody. You can also manage the apps you're using with Sign-In through Google Plus.
Speaking of Google, Google's about to solve one of the biggest annoyances of tabbed browsing. The company is working on a way to identify which Chrome tab is playing audio or even recording audio. The favicon of the tab would show animated meters to alert you which one of those tabs is squawking at you. The audio detection feature is currently in testing. It was spotted in the latest Chromium build. It's unknown whether this feature will work with plugins like Flash.
Actually, I saw an article that confirmed that it would work with Flash.
Oh, awesome.
So good news, everyone. This episode of Tech News Today brought to you by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell last year's gadgets. You got new gadgets, right? We got a bunch of new stuff coming out all the time now. Mobile World Congress announcements flying around. You probably got something maybe for the holidays, and you got some old stuff sitting around. It's springtime, right? Catchers and pitchers are out there at spring training throwing balls around, and it's time for you to do some spring cleaning. Get rid of those old gadgets. Take them over to gazelle.com. It's not a hassle. You just go to gazelle.com, G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com. Tell Gazelle the condition of your old gadget. They'll even buy broken iPhones and iPads. Then you get a risk-free offer for your gadgets. You have 30 days to decide if you want to sell it. You know? Yeah. And so there's really no reason not to investigate. Find out how much you're going to get. Once you do decide to sell it, you'll get paid fast by check or PayPal. So go to gazelle.com. Get an offer for your iPhone or your Android or your BlackBerry phone or your iPad, other Apple products. Do it today, though, because your gadgets are going to lose value. And you still got that lock-in of 30 days. Once you put the price in today, that price is good for a month. So go check it out. You'll get paid in cash. Gazelle.com. Fast shipping. Most items even qualify for a free box if you don't have a box lying around. iPhone 4s, iPhone 4s, iPad 2s. Sell last year's gadgets today at gazelle.com. And we thank them for their support of Tech News Today. Also want to thank Ken Ray, host of macOS Ken, for joining us today on Tech News Today. Been too long, Ken. How's it going, man?
Going all right, Tom. How are you?
I am doing well. We got lots of juicy tech news to discuss. We actually discussed this a little bit yesterday, Firefox OS, but Mozilla Chief Executive Gary Kovacs gave a keynote at Mobile World Congress. So less particularly about Firefox OS, but more just about his view of things. You heard Sarah talk about one of the quotes about farmers having different needs from executives. He also thinks there should be fragmentation. That's kind of what the headlines are saying, the sensationalist headlines. But he's like, there should be many app stores, many models, many payment mechanisms, many providers, many services. There should not be one or two providers approving content. He is also pushing HTML5. Ken, what do you think about that argument against fragmentation, or for fragmentation, I guess?
I don't know. There was actually, in the article that I read about it, it struck me as kind of odd. He's, you know, saying that the needs of the farmer in India, as Sarah read earlier, the needs of the farmer in India aren't going to be the same as the lawyer in New York. But then he's also pushing web apps, which sort of seem to be, I don't want to say they're catch-all, but they kind of are catch-all. I mean, everybody can just, you know, go online to the things that they need rather than going to the individual app stores, things like that. The one thing that I wondered about is, when Steve Jobs tried to push the idea of web apps when they first released the iPhone back in 2007, didn't people kind of reject that? I mean, web apps were just sort of treated with sort of a meh, and then people started jailbreaking and started building their own apps, and so Apple the next year comes out with the App Store, and then everybody is coming out with their own app stores afterwards. I mean, I like the idea of web apps personally. I hope that eventually that's the way things go, but the whole, I don't know, there was something about his the way he was pushing it that didn't quite sit right with me.
Well, and a lot of people have felt that apps are sort of a bridge that we needed to use to get us over the hump to better HTML5 standardization. There's actually a new survey today out commissioned by Telerik's Kendo UI that the majority of developers now prefer to work with HTML5 instead of native apps for cross-platform development. We saw the opposite recently with Facebook, who got off of HTML5 because they said it just couldn't do what they wanted it to do. But it looks like we're actually headed to a more HTML5 friendly world, which would mean more web apps. So maybe it was just too early when Jobs pushed it. Another quote from Kovacs was, since the walls of AOL came down, we've had a 1,000% increase in content online. And he's kind of comparing this round of Firefox OS coming to mobile to, like, we're going to do it again. What we did for browsers, we're going to do for mobile. Sarah, what do you think the chances of that are?
I've always been a fan of Firefox. It's not my OS of choice these days, but it's really through no fault of its own. But you know, that's the thing, is that I have so many choices, right? So I say Firefox OS, that's kind of interesting. I think what it comes down to is the load placed on developers, right? I mean, developers are making these apps, these services, these HTML5 apps, stuff like that, that can either be run in a browser or they're standalone apps. And there's a lot of choice that has to happen on the developer side. And you hear time and time again, it's not necessarily that a developer or a company says, yeah, we're only interested in Android. We're only interested in, you know, one certain OS. It's simply the bandwidth that they have. And then you get on the consumer side, people like me who say, I want that service or that app that everybody's talking about. So if that's not something that I can achieve on Firefox OS, what is my incentive for more fragmentation in the market?
What do you think, dude? Are we fine as we are with Android and iOS winning the game, and then some scraps for everybody else? Or do we think we need Firefox to come in and disrupt, or anybody? Really?
Well, I mean, whether there's a disruptive force or not, the developers are going to go where there's a mature platform, right? The thing is, where there are users, developers will flock to. Although that's kind of that chicken and egg kind of thing. But these app stores got people to download applications and got them to use that a lot more than HTML5 apps, because HTML5 and standards committees in general move really slowly. So when those platforms are mature enough, that seems to attract developers, because you know what you're doing at some point, because you're like, oh, okay, the iOS SDK works like this, the Android SDK works like this, and now these HTML5 apps will work consistently. But so far, we haven't seen that across the board, that browser-based applications will work the same on every single browser. And that's where the issue is. But more competition is always better, although it makes me slightly concerned. If you think about smart TVs, they have lots of disparate app stores. They have lots of disparate ideas, and a lot of people aren't developing for that just because there are so many options.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are down on HTML5 because it got overhyped too early, and part of that may be Apple's fault. So I think now we're finally seeing developers saying, yeah, we're actually interested in developing for this. It's it's going to become a standard now. That's the time to actually say, okay, let's see what it really can do. Go ahead, Ken.
Well, no, I was just going to ask really quickly, can we go back then to how do the developers make money off of it specifically? I mean, even if you do sort of a more open approach, or an approach that can lay over everything, Apple seems to keep showing that developers developing for iOS can make money. Not all of them, certainly. In fact, not most of them, according to a lot of reports. But I mean, there's sort of it's not quite the lottery. But I mean, a well-developed app for iOS that does catch on stands to make serious bank. And if you're then having to sort of reinvent that money side of things, does that not become a hindrance for developing for it as well, or for adoption for it as well?
Well, Apple would have to get into the game of saying, we're going to have HTML5 web apps available in the store, the way that the Chrome OS store has them, or Firefox is doing. Okay. But that would be a change. That would be a big change. Another big change is Samsung taking over the Android world. It's not just that iOS and Android have sort of dominated the mobile world. It's also that Samsung has pretty much become synonymous with Android's dominance. Is that or is that not a problem, Iyaz Akhtar?
It's causing a problem for Google, at least. Wall Street Journal is reporting that Google's getting nervous about Samsung's dominance in Android. Specifically, Google executives fear that since Samsung sells about 40% of Android devices, it could use that as leverage to renegotiate Samsung and Google's deal that eats into Google's mobile ad business. Now, Samsung in the past has received more than 10% of Google's online advertising revenue generated from its web search engine, according to the journal's sources. I had no idea that was happening. Andy Rubin, head of Android, was talking at Mobile World Congress, and he's saying, there's one big company that's been hugely successful. That's mostly about execution. It's not mostly around Android. Let's talk about Samsung there. He says, should I be unfair to Samsung? I can't do that. I have to be fair to everyone. Ken, what do you think Google can do about something like this? I mean, they can't control the platform where they take it away from Samsung, but should they be worried?
Should Google... maybe Google should double down on what they're doing with Motorola. I mean, is that was part of the, that was the question, what, like a year ago, year and a half ago, right? When Google went to buy Motorola, is, you know, how were people going to react? How were Samsung going to react and their other partners? I mean, what can... I don't know. I apologize. I don't know what Google can do about them. I don't know why Google would want to do anything different about them, honestly, because, I mean, they're still making money off of them, right?
Right. Yeah, I think that's a perfectly fair answer. The thing is, like, I was trying to figure out this morning, what could Google possibly do? There's really nothing they can do other than bolster up competition. Tom, do you think they should be doing that with their Motorola divisions, or should they be playing a little bit more favorites with HTC and LG?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? The danger of Samsung taking over is that they then leverage a better deal, right? They tell Google, yeah, we're actually going to give you less money for using Android because what are you going to do? We dominate this space. And so Google's worried about their revenue getting cut into. At the same time, I think Google put itself in a corner when they bought Motorola. They had the idea that we're going to buy Motorola, we're going to use its patents, and then we're going to wall it off and slowly figure out what to do with it. Because unlike most acquisitions, Google has not brought Motorola into the Google fold. They still have Motorola badges, a different campus, and everything. So I think now they're worried, okay, how do we combat Samsung's dominance without appearing to favor our own? Or do we change our mind and favor our own? Or do we favor anyone? And that's what Andy Rubin said. He's like, I can't be unfair to anyone. It's a tough spot for Google to be in, especially because they actually have influence over one of the players in the marketplace.
It's sort of weird, though. I mean, if you look at Andy Rubin's quote where he says Samsung's been hugely successful, that's about their execution. It's not about Android. I mean, it makes it sound like he's saying Android didn't make Samsung what it is today. Samsung could be running another OS and have great execution, and they don't need us. I'm not sure where he's going with that, because it makes it seem like Android is not responsible for Samsung's success,
I took it differently.
Equates Samsung with.
I took it as Samsung just is the best at using Android, so the other manufacturers better step up.
Yeah.
Ken, do you think that Samsung would jump ship from Android? I mean, they've dabbled with Windows Phone. They've had previous, they have their own operating systems out there. Would they just go, look, we can take our TouchWiz UI and put it on anything. What's the point of hanging out with Android if Google's going to be a pain?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, there was actually, I did a story, I can't remember if it was yesterday or the day before, on macOS, kind of about, is it Tizen? Is that what it's called?
Tizen.
T-I-Z-E-N?
Yeah.
Tizen. Oh, great. So I mispronounced that for everybody. But Tizen, I mean, they do have that they could go to. I find it hard to believe that they're actually going to do that. I mean, they can all stand there and say, well, you would be nothing without me. You would be nothing without me. But people are now comfortable with iOS and Android here in the States. There are still some people that are interested in BlackBerry, and there are some people who are starting to get into Windows Phone. But it's hard for me to see them bringing an entirely new operating system, you know, just to put a thumb in Google's eye. That said, the advertising, I mean, Andy Rubin's kind of right. The advertising that Samsung has done has been against Apple. It's been about the devices. It's been about, you know, the size of the device, what you can do with the device. It hasn't been the strength of Android. So, I mean, that's kind of a weird thing for him to say out loud since he's the Android guy. But, I mean, he's also kind of right. The question is, can Tizen come out with enough stuff that people won't even notice the operating system is different when they look at a Samsung phone? Are we still selling on the gadget rather than on the system? I guess would be the question.
Another marketplace that Google is trying to make headway in is social networking. There's lots of debates whether Google Plus is popular or not, but they're adding a function now that puts it directly in competition with Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah, in fact, anyone who's familiar with Facebook Connect to quickly sort of port information over to a site or service from Facebook will be at least familiar with how Google Plus sign-in works. That's Google's answer to Facebook Connect. So what it is, it's a login for websites or mobile apps. So you can port over some of your Google Plus information. This is something that I use with both Twitter and Facebook all the time. I sign up for something and they say, do you want to start with a new account from scratch, or do you want to use Facebook Connect? And so it brings in my profile picture and some of my information. It knows who my friends are, etc. So you can choose what friends or circles you share with when you decide to share, maybe let's say an article or a piece of news from a particular site. There is a private setting available, the system works with Google's two-factor authentication, which, you know, anybody who likes to have that on as much as possible will probably like that. That's a nice little feature. Android users get one-step extra functionality that a web or iOS users do not. When logging into a site, they can push any mobile app version directly to their phone. And then there's a couple different ways that you can share. There's passive sharing, so that's like, I'm listening to this kind of music. That's not going to be pushed onto all of your Google Plus feeds. Google says, listen, we understand that some of these, the way that these services do it, feel very spammy to people. We don't want to do that. If you go to Sarah's profile, you would see the music that she's listening to, if she has indeed chosen to share it with you, but it's not like it's going to be popping up in all of your notifications. Then there's something called active sharing, which is a direct post to the Google Plus feed of the person that I'm reaching out to. So it's interactive sharing, basically what Google says. And it's kind of interesting. There'll be a post that appears, if I'm sharing it with you, as a card, a stylized card that has a call to action. So if I was sharing, I don't know, some sort of a HDMI cable for whatever, you know, but just to use an example, there'd be a buy button if I'm sharing from an e-commerce site, or maybe a listen button if I'm sharing a song and I've chosen to blast that out so that you could then click on the song and go ahead and buy it. What's kind of interesting is that the article from The Verge that I read used a company called Beautylish, which is a e-commerce beauty site, as an example of one of Google Plus's sign-in launch partners for the buying of things. And when a positive review is shared from that website, it would trigger an add to cart button that allows people to start buying right away. Beautylish says that they are now dropping Twitter sign-in as an option. So they're going to be going forward with Google Plus sign-in and then Facebook Connect only, which makes me think that Google Plus may be forcing some launch partners to drop Twitter as a contingency, because I see really no other reason why Beautylish would just say, now that Google Plus has this as an option, Twitter is completely useless to us. I don't know. Ayaz, what do you think? Is this going to help Google Plus seem more alive to you? I know that you're on the site pretty regularly.
I'm on Google Plus. Yeah, I've been using Google Plus a lot more lately. But the thing about Facebook Connect or Google Plus and using these one sign-in things, I mean, I think it's going to help Google say that a lot of people are using Google Plus right now, because the way they define a user is pretty much anybody that uses Google at all while signed in. And when they get to do this, they'll be able to tout the same numbers that Facebook gets to by saying, hey, look, you signed in with Facebook Connect, you're an active user. So I think it's going to give Google Plus a bit of more clout in the social networking world, because for the most part, a lot of people just look at Google Plus as this echo chamber of nerds talking. It's all about Google Plus and how it's better than Facebook, even though they're trying to branch out a lot. I think this is going to help out a lot to give Google Plus a more well-accepted feel.
That's really interesting. It took so long for me to actually do Facebook Connect with anything. I think what it finally was Spotify, because I really enjoyed the social angle of that. I resisted doing any of the Facebook Connect things up to that point. And there's something about me when I read this story about Google Plus, I'm kind of having the same feeling. Like, okay, so Google has all of my, you know, I know Google already has all of your information. And I feel like an old man when I read this story. I know Google already has all my information, but the idea of, okay, well, I'm going to turn this on now. So I'm going to voluntarily give Google even more information than they have. Now, a part of that maybe though, I've sort of missed, I'm not like you, I've sort of missed the Google Plus train. I have a Google, I was part of it. I joined it. I was active there for a little while, but after a while, it sort of became kind of like what you're talking about, to me anyway, where it was, you know, geeks talking to geeks. And I just went back to, you know, the other stuff that I had. My mom is who I talk to on Facebook. My mom and high school friends, and they're not on, you know, Google Plus. And then the people that I talk to outside of that, I actually email or talk to or Skype or things like that.
Ken, do you think that Google's at least what they're saying, they're trying to enter the space being a little bit less spammy than the Facebook version? Because on the surface, this seems a lot like, oh, okay, they, you know, we want to basically use your data to spread around the internet as well. But you mentioned Spotify as a reason that you kind of liked about using Facebook Connect. It sounds like Google says, yeah, a lot of that stuff is a little bit too much for our users. We don't want to overwhelm them. We just want to give them deeper integration.
Well, I mean, it still depends on how you use it, right? I mean, I used it in Spotify because I actually like going into the Spotify app and seeing what my friends have chosen. I'm not paying attention, I don't think I'm spamming everybody with everything that I'm listening to on Facebook, because there are some things I listen to that are just for me and my friends don't need to know that. I like the idea of what Google's saying, that it's not going to be so spammy, but I would want to, and I would need to go in and look at the look at the settings and see how they, I would need to go in and play with that to find out. Yeah, it's a neat idea. But again, if it's going to be not so spammy to Google Plus, where most of my friends aren't anyway, then that's not doing a whole lot, you know, for me personally.
All right, let's take a quick break. We got a few more stories to discuss and one around AppNet that kind of continues this conversation a little bit. But I want to thank our sponsor, RingCentral. We've told you about RingCentral a bunch on this show, about how when we built the studio, we didn't want to spend a lot of money running an old PBX system in the basement, how we, you know, a cloud-based phone system was pretty attractive, and Russell came and said, you got to try out RingCentral. So we did. Zero startup costs, no hardware to install or maintain in the basement, none of that old-fashioned PBX stuff. RingCentral allows us to easily customize all of our call handling. You can get your voicemail and your email. You can get your fax messages on your smartphones for those people who insist on sending you faxes. And they have a new feature, business SMS. Now you can send text messages to customers and colleagues from your business phone number. So you don't have to use your personal phone number for business stuff because you got the RingCentral phone. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing as low as $20 a month per user, and you can start right now, 30 days risk-free, and they have a special offer for our listeners. When you buy one desk phone, get the second one free. It's like two for one, up to 20 phones. So call this number. It's for our listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. Helps if I say it right, 800-543-9980. Or you can also go to ringcentral.com. Use the promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT. And we thank them for their support of Tech News Today. So app.net has been laboring in its closed wall wonderment for a while. People are still using it, but they're opening it up now a little bit.
Yeah, app.net is opening up to more people with a free tier. Here's how it works. If you receive an invite from a paying member of app.net, you can join and use app.net for free. Now, paying members receive 10 gigabytes of cloud storage for $36 a year or $5 a month. Both the invited person and the inviter receive 100 megabytes of additional storage if they follow at least 5 other accounts, and the invited member authorizes a third-party app. The free tier is limited compared to the paid ones. The free one can follow a maximum of 40 users. You get 500 megabytes of storage instead of 10 gigabytes, and you can upload a file with a maximum size of 10 megabytes as opposed to 100 megabytes for a paid account. Sarah, do you think all these conditions for the free version, will these help app.net use grow and have a larger user base?
Okay, well, I'm a paying member of app.net, but I must admit I use it very infrequently. It has not compelled me to return on a regular basis. So the problem I have already is that on app.net, I find, not that there aren't enough users for me to, you know, populate a feed, but not enough users that I know or have, you know, stuff in common with. It just doesn't feel like it's a robust community. So as a paying member, sure, I could invite somebody who's not on app.net and then they don't have to pay, which is sort of one of those early adopter things where I'm like, why'd I have to pay? We could get some additional storage. You have an incentive to follow at least 5 other accounts, which I don't really like that, because that already gives this incentivizing behavior that might not be normal behavior for us. But then to max out at 40 users if you're not going to pay at all. I mean, I think I maxed out at 40 users and I am paying already. So it's like, I mean, what is this? Supposed to be some sort of a closed network thing? I don't really get how this is going to attract a lot of people.
Yeah, the chat room. Some people are asking, what is app.net? I forgot to mention it. It's a paid, ad-free social network. Right now you pay a monthly subscription fee or a yearly subscription fee, and you get access to a social network that won't be selling and doing things like Twitter did. This was basically a reaction to Twitter's API changes, and the way Twitter works now seems to be, at least in the opinion of the founders of app.net, is a reactionary thing to its advertisers. Ken, do you think this is going to have a lot more third-party app developers excited about app.net? You can, hey, look, you can actually have a lot more applications because these people will have to sign up because they're new.
I am the wrong person to ask. Had I been in the chat room, I would have been one of the people saying, what is app.net?
Yeah.
I apologize. The idea of a social network that's ad-free is kind of cool, but the problem is, I mean, this is the same problem that I've had with Google Plus. There are lots of cool people on Google Plus, but they're, you know, that's not where most of the people that I know are. So am I supposed to try to draw people over to app.net, or is somebody supposed to be trying to draw me over there? Because so far, neither of those things have happened.
Yeah, app.net definitely has that, another closed echo chamber kind of thing where people are just talking about app.net or versus Twitter. Tom, what do you think of this development? Do you think this is actually going to get this to grow? Because it seems like when app.net came out, it was kind of a cool idea, but people bristled at the price.
Yeah, I don't. I think this is probably a signal that app.net's in trouble. And I actually liked the idea of it, but it shows that it's a lot harder to grow your user base when you close things off and make it hard to share. I've forgotten that I was a member of it. I don't hear anybody talk about it. Obviously, there's lots of people in the chat room and even on the show who aren't aware. They have an awareness problem, and it's hard, you know, when you want to gain awareness on the internet, to have a closed system like that. So they're acknowledging that. But once you let down one of these walls, then it becomes, well, why am I only 40? You know, and why is that restriction? Why would I use it for free if it has restrictions when I can use Twitter for free with no restrictions? I don't know. I think this is a bad sign. Yeah. I don't think it's working.
Other premium models have worked out there. Evernote's out there. It has a ton of free subscribers, and a lot of people pay for it because it has added functionality. I just think right now that the social media space is kind of, I wouldn't say it's full, but when you have these major players like Twitter, Google, and Facebook, all the, they're the top three guys when it comes to social media. It seems very hard for a paid service to try to enter that, even with the promise of this is about the users, because the free option, while it may be somewhat annoying with its ads, is still free.
App.net went the other direction, too. Evernote was free, and then they said, hey, and if you pay, you get a little more. App.net's saying, hey, if you pay, you get everything, and then we'll add a free tier for you. It just does it. It's kind of a backwards way to do it. Financial Times reporting today that IFPI says recorded music revenues grew in 2012 for the first time since 1999. Now, we've had digital sales growing for a long time, but overall, digital sales had not been making up the shortfall of physical sales until this past year. So digital downloads and subscription services made up a third of the $16.5 billion in the industry, up 9%. Physical sales fell 5%, but that was fine. That was enough to make revenue grow. At the same time, P2P music downloads fell 17%, according to NPD, and illegal P2P music sales, which thank you, NPD, for making the distinction, fell 26%. So people are just not using P2P for music generally, whether it's legal or not. And illegal music sharing on P2P declined quite a bit. Ripped CDs fell 44%. Hard drive swaps fell 25%. Digital lockers fell 28%. 40% of illegal downloaders stopped in 2012. And 50% of those stopped because they're like, I got a Spotify or an RDO. I got one of those streaming services. It's just a lot easier. So I think this shows that the battle was about convenience, not about price. Ken, do you agree?
Wow. Yes. How's that? I mean, I love the fact that, I mean, when you point to things like RDO and Spotify, I've been a huge proponent of those for a very long time. It's always bothered me as an Apple fan that Apple, for some reason, refuses to get into that. And then, you know, every year, it seems like every year at Christmas, we hear that Apple's going to get into some kind of radio thing or something like that. I honestly don't care if they do anymore because I'm such a huge fan of Spotify now. So you're right, the convenience part of it. I also wonder, though, if it's like, this may sound, again, just doing the whole old man thing. I wonder if it has to do with where we are at this point. I mean, when you and I were at Tech TV in 2000, I had a, what was it called?
Oh, Napster.
Sean Fanning. Thank you. I had a Napster. I had a Napster yeah. sign in, and I was taking songs willy nilly because it wasn't even illegal at the time. Sure, it was, but we didn't realize it because it was so new, right? There are now 13-year-olds who weren't born when Napster was out there, so they've grown up like not with the novelty of, hey, there's free music out there, and we shouldn't worry about the legality or shouldn't even think about it. I mean, they were one, they were two, they were five when the iTunes Music Store, you know, was a store. And so as they're getting older, it's just natural to buy music online, right? It seems like. I mean, that's one possibility. The convenience thing is certainly another. And also coming across something like e-music, I think, was the first one that I paid for
yeah.
regularly. And it didn't even have a lot of music on there that you knew, but you could discover some interesting music. And I think that was like $10 a month or maybe less, and you got X number of downloads. So that was kind of right. cool. iTunes is different, especially after it went to $1.29, because there's a difference. There's just a psychological difference between 99 cents. That's less than a dollar. I've got a dollar in my pocket. Here you go. And $1.29, because it's, oh, well, that's getting into $2. And that feels like a little bit more. So I love Spotify, and I love services like it where it's got almost everything. And it's not free, but it feels free. Like if I feel like listening to Nine Inch Nails and then, you know, 20 minutes later, I feel like listening to Toby Keith. Well, I've got both of those, and I've got Mozart, and I've got, you know, Glenn Gould, all points in between. So, yeah, it probably is about convenience. But then also I think it's about age. It's about where we are and like who the consumers are starting to be.
Sarah, do you think that the legal enforcement of this has played any part?
I doubt it. Well, no, I don't want to say it has played no part. I certainly would not want to get some sort of a letter from someone saying, we know that you've been illegally downloading music. But then again, I feel like I've made the choice to plunk down a little bit of money each month so that I have all the access to all the music that I could ever want, more than I could ever want. So there's definitely some wastage there, but I don't have to put it anywhere. You know, I don't have to have some sort of a hard drive where stuff is filling up and I've got to maintain any of this. I love the convenience factor of this. Also, numbers like this lead me to believe that Spotify's onto something when they want to go back to the record labels and start negotiating better deals. People, this is a solution that's working for more and more people. Not only is it cutting down on piracy, but it's allowing artists to be better discovered. They're going to get less money per listen than they would if I were to buy an album and download it from, you know, something more traditional like an iTunes store. But there is less of that overall, and there's more streaming. And I think that that's a good thing for the music industry.
Yeah, I think wastage, the industry works on wastage. And the wastage before was I buy an album maybe for two songs and I get all 12. So I'm buying songs that maybe I wouldn't buy otherwise. The wastage now is paying for a streaming service, right? A lot of people don't even, they sign up for it and then it just kind of automatically bills every month whether they use it or not. So there's a little bit of overhead there and a little bit of inefficiency to take advantage of. And the industry loves that kind of thing. Let's finish
up. They also love recurring revenue. I mean, it's absolutely recurring
guaranteed revenue they could put on the books. Absolutely.
Exactly. If I buy, you know, if I buy a CD in January, there's no guarantee I'm going to buy another CD until December when it's, you know, time to go Christmas shopping or something like that. But it is kind of amazing to me. I know people who are paid members of Spotify, and because of that social thing, I can see that they haven't listened to songs in like a month and a half, 2 months. And it's just because, you know, she's not still listening to Suede Head. I know that. But, you know, it has said that for, you know, the past couple of months. Different friends, different things. I had one who had, like, Luther Vandross up for 6 months, this one song, you know, forever. So, I mean, there are people who are paying for it and they're not getting anything out of it. So that's kind of the wastage thing. But, yeah, the record industry would just absolutely kill for that because they know I'm good for $9.95 a month until I cancel, which most people aren't going to do.
Let's finish up talking about Opera moving to WebKit. We finally got their announcement from Barcelona. What did they say, Sarah?
Well, Android is a priority for Opera. In fact, in the second quarter, we're going to see Opera on Android. As we have talked about in the past, Opera's dumping Presto, which was you know, its own internal operation for open source WebKit, which obviously Chrome and Safari both use. And CEO Lars Boilesen says, listen, Opera wants to be innovative. But we're trying to compete on something where there's no perceived value or benefit for the user. So we're going WebKit. And the first priority is Opera for Android, which will work on Android 2.3, which, of course, is Gingerbread. And it has a few new features that we've seen. There's one called off-road mode. Some people might be familiar with this. For a couple of years ago, Opera said that it was going to come out with this. It's basically like a mini browser that's relying on servers to kind of simplify web pages and send lightweight versions of them to phones. So, you know, cutting down on crazy data load. Also, there's a new service called Speed Dial. It's a new feature, which merges the browser's bookmarking tool so you can collect your preferred websites on a launch page. You can group those multiple Speed Dial icons kind of the way that you can in iOS or Android, you know, put them in folders, that sort of thing with different apps. There's a private browsing mode. You can swipe to the left from a speed dial to show a new feature called Discovery, and this is kind of cool. It shows a grid of web pages that are selected to you to be of interest to you based on your preferences, you set, where you are, if you're a man or a woman, possibly to be monetized in the future with ads, of course, because Opera's in the business of making money. Jason, I mean, you're the Android expert of the group. Does this excite you?
I think that there is already a lot of kind of a big bit of competition with Chrome. It's going to be, as people move over to Ice Cream Sandwich and beyond in greater numbers, it's going to be really hard to kind of break against that kind of trend, which is the fact that Google already has their Chrome browser probably built into most of these phones. It has sync that ties into all the other Google services anyways, which is a huge strength, strong point for Android, which is a huge reason why people choose Android to begin with, is all of that integration. Opera, there are plenty of browsers on Android that survive for their own reasons, but once Chrome came around, like, what was the last one? Dolphin was a huge browser for the longest time. It was just kind of known as the great alternative browser to the horrible, you know, crappy browser that's built into your phone. Once Chrome came around, you stopped hearing about Dolphin. It's really hard to compete with that behemoth.
Yeah, but Chrome works on Ice Cream Sandwich and higher, right? That's 4.0
right.
And higher.
That's what I mean.
And the fact that Opera's bothering to go with 2.3 and higher lets it get into a market that Chrome just can't go onto unless you do some workarounds.
Sure.
But the thing is, if Opera did this about when it was like when Honeycomb came out, this would be really great.
Mm-hmm.
But it does show you that the fact is, when it comes to Android, you can always choose your browser as your
default.
So the thing is, if they can really make a push, they might be able to win over some people, because when you're on Android, you're likely to go, you know what, I can switch browsers when I want. I can go ahead and change my default. But I think it's a little late for it. Also, I think the turbo mode, or their off-road mode, as they're calling it, I think that's going to be a good hook, especially if you have a 2.3 device that has a crappy network.
Right.
It might be a faster experience. So if they can win on experience, I think they got a small chance, at least on the low-end market.
Yeah, and if they make enough of an impression for those users, then potentially if and when those users ever do upgrade, maybe they stick with Opera. But you're right. I mean, that's kind of the beauty of Android, right, is that you can select the default for all these things and kind of force that integration throughout your OS as kind of the default throughout and kind of make it seamless. So, sure, they have a chance. I'm curious to play around with it and see.
Sure. All right, let's get invisible with the randomizer. An invisibility cloak was showed off in Long Beach, according to Carla Sinclair on the Boing Boing blog. They're doing their four-minute TED fellow talks. And Bale Zhang, an assistant professor of physics at Nanyang Technology University in Singapore, demonstrated an invisibility cloak as a piece of... I don't want to get the material wrong, but it was a piece of material of translucent material he placed over a Post-it note, and it made the Post-it note disappear. Yeah, you know, just an invisibility cloak being demonstrated for a real person. You're right. It's not that interesting, is it?
I think the problem was that the video that was supposed to be attached to this Boing Boing article was hosted on Dropbox, and then it got so popular that you couldn't access it anymore. So the one image you have, you kind of stare at it, and you're like, well, I don't see anything. That's the whole point, that you don't see anything. But like, if you're watching the video right now, there's an orange paperclip or some kind of a bar there, and there's a video not showing up.
Yeah, I was trying. It's a Post-it note. It's a pad of Post-it paper.
Thank you. It's Post-it.
That and Post-it, so you can see the middle of it disappears.
Right. I mean, it's an interesting idea. But I mean, I think part of it is just being taken away from the fact there's no video of it yet, because...
So there's no video. It's not impressive.
I'm not saying it's not impressive. I'm just saying it's probably why we were just kind of stunned by it, looking at... What are we looking at?
Is it about the people on the audio podcast?
Like the end of the magic show, right? You know, like seeing the disappearing act is part of the fun. So this is cool.
Most of our audience is listening, not watching anyway.
Well, there must be. I'm sure they're super impressed by the theory of this. When they get to see the video or watch the images of this or look at the images, this should have been an animated GIF at least. But this is in the audio. It's like this. There's noise. It's quiet.
There's no video of it yet. No. There's got to be a video.
No,
of
I was answering your direct question. You asked if we were impressed, and I said we weren't.
What's actually funny is the way you said it, Tom. Was they put this piece of cloth over the Post-it, and then you couldn't see the Post-it. And I'm thinking, well, that sounds like cloth. Putting a piece of cloth
I
over
said
a Post-it.
Translucent.
Okay. No, that's material. True.
I said material that made you think cloth. That's my problem.
I call Photoshop.
Nice. I mean, it is sort of the problem of once we see it. I mean, you're right. It sounds very impressive, but it's also one of those things that until you see it, you're sort of like, you don't want to be the idiot that goes to your friends and say, so I heard they have this, like, you know, thing that makes you invisible. And that's pretty much, we need to see it.
So I'm not sorry. Seeing is believing. I mean, seeing the fact that you can't see it.
Pics and it didn't happen.
Yeah. Pics or it didn't happen doesn't work in this case. It's video or it didn't happen.
We've been reporting on this technology
from
Buzz Out Loud days through today constantly without seeing any kind of demonstrations, and it's blown my mind every time. Now the fact that somebody demonstrated it for real in person with just plastic, right? Not like a bunch of generators and a bunch of machines and waveform anomalies. It was just like, boom. Now it's invisible. That's pretty. And you could see through. You could see through to the thing behind it.
That's pretty incredible. No, that's incredible. You're right. I apologize for not being as well out as I should have been initially.
Don't need to apologize. Let's move on to the calendar.
No one wants to be invisible. What can I say? Groupon earnings are tomorrow, February 27th. So we'll see how, you know, daily deals are going in the Groupon space. Google I.O. registration begins on March 13th at 7 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Yeah, it's going to be daylight time by then. Requires both a Google Plus and Google Wallet account. So remember how crazy it was last year? It's like the whole thing sold out in like a second. So get on that if you're interested. The Nintendo Wii Mini is arriving in the UK on March 22nd. And finally, MetroPCS and T-Mobile are moving forward with their deal. There's a shareholder vote scheduled for March 28th.
Let's see what's incoming.
Incoming message.
Always a message.
We got a message from Shorty in Florida. He wrote that. I didn't write that. Shorty in Florida says, hey, a while back you were discussing a story about Office for iPad. You referenced an article that said Microsoft was leaving money on the table by not selling it. I was thinking that instead of selling it, they may just give it away. Sounds crazy, I know. Microsoft has started transitioning people towards subscription models with Office. Microsoft could give the app away but require you to log in using your Microsoft ID and verify a subscription to Office to use it, thus bypassing the 30% that Apple charges and drive more people onto the subscription model. It's an interesting idea. Ken, do you think that Microsoft should just give away Office for iPad if they ever did it?
Well, it wouldn't actually be giving away Office for iPad, would it? It's sort of like that thing where you go to a newsstand and they're like, hey, you get the free, you know, Time Magazine app, and you get the free Time Magazine app, and it's a two-page thing explaining why you should subscribe to Time Magazine. So I don't know. I mean, just like we talked about with the music industry, Microsoft is obviously pushing people towards the subscription services. They would much rather have the recurring revenue because once you get people using Office, right, and used to the idea of paying for it, they're going to freak out at the idea of not paying for it for fear that they're going to lose the stuff that they've already put in. At the same time, it would be a boon for the iPad and business, it seems to me. I mean, it seems like everybody who's buying the iPad currently for businesses, I mean, that's an automatic however much they're going to charge for it. And they could probably charge significantly more than Apple is charging for the iWorks week. So I think it's $30 for Keynote, Pages, and Numbers total. And business would easily pay much more than that just for a one-off for the iPad. But then again, big business is probably going to go ahead and pay for the subscription for Office, whether it's on the iPad or the Dell Latitude 10 with super secret security or, you know, whatever other tablet they're able to put Office or Office 365 on.
Yeah, I hate to say it, Shorty, but they're going to make any iOS version of Office part of the subscription package. That's just a given. How they'll deal with Apple's subscription cut is up for debate, but nobody's going to get it for free. It'll just be part of your subscription to Office 365. That's almost a known fact. At least that's what Mary Jo Foley has been saying. Well, that's it for this episode of Tech News Today. Ken Ray, a pleasure thank you so much for joining us today. Let folks know about macOS Ken and where they can find it and where they can find all the things you do online.
macOS Ken is a daily Apple news and news related to Apple News audio podcast, Monday through Friday. Runs anywhere from 12 to 20 minutes, depending on how much news there is that day. And you can find it at macosken.com or, of course, on iTunes or wherever fine podcasts are served. Oh, and on Twitter, at macosken.
I got to be on one of your shows, too. That was fun. It's a good yeah. conversation.
Thank you very much for doing that. It was great. Yes. Are people taking technology seriously enough? Put that to your, put that to the chat room. I feel certain they'll say no.
Say now, now, people. That's it for us. TechNewsToday.reddit.com, the place to go to submit stories to our subreddit. Let us know what stuff you'd like us to cover. You can find us on the web at twit.tv/TNT. You can email us, TNT@twit.tv, or give us a call. Leave us a voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW. Lauren Good from All Things D joins us tomorrow. We'll see you then.